One, yeah, it does. VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, Dan Novak tells us why environmental groups are calling for more openness among fishing regulators. Andrew Smith presents this week's Education Report. We close the show with the next part of our U.S. History series. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Environmental groups and fishing interests are criticizing regional organizations set up by the United Nations to supervise fishing activities around the world. The groups say the UN bodies need to be clearer and more open about what they are doing. There are about 50 fisheries management organizations around the world. They bring together local fishers, coastal states, and big international fishers. They help regulate fishing rights for companies and countries in a way that is meant to conserve populations of fish and other ocean animals. For years, these regulators have been accused of undemocratic practices that favor big industrial fishers. Now, several conservation groups are calling for a change. Groups like the Ocean Foundation and the Global Tuna Alliance have supported more openness about the fisheries organization's decisions. They say more openness will permit more members of the public to take part in conservation efforts. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, oversees fisheries management organizations. The FAO said it supports more openness in fisheries. But for local and small fishers who depend on well-managed fish populations, it's unclear if more open measures will help. Kasim Abdallah is a fisherman on Kenya's coast. He is part of a cooperative group of fishers. I only hear of meetings on fisheries, but I have no idea what it is they discuss there. I have never been invited, he said. He added that he cannot compete with large fisheries from developed nations. The concern among environmentalists and small fishers is that large fishing boats can do things that are not possible for smaller boats. Their activities take fish supplies from fishers who must stay close to the coast. If there are no fish close to the coast, smaller fishers must take their boats farther out to sea, which is more dangerous. Many industrial fishing boats use a method called purse seining. Frederick Monick said this method uses 2-kilometer-long nets that surround whole schools of fish. Monick is a marine scientist with the ocean conservation group Bloom. Purse seining makes it difficult to protect fish populations, he said. The European Union is closely involved in 8 regional fisheries management organizations worldwide. The EU has been accused of using methods like purse seining. Critics also say the EU pressures coastal states to get better access to regional fishery management organizations. The EU Commission denied the claims. It said it is not suppressing developing countries for more favorable access. It also said that it would ban purse seining if science supported a ban. But it is essential that science is the backbone of decision-making, EU officials said. Monarch said the regulatory bodies need to be more open about how they set fishing limits for countries and groups. There is absolutely no transparency surrounding how limits are set and who gets them, he said. Last month, the UN High Seas Treaty was finally approved. The treaty will create a new body to manage conservation of ocean life and establish protected areas in the world's oceans. The hope for conservation groups is that fishery bodies involve small fishers in the discussions. Ryan Orguera is with Accountability Fish, a non-profit group based in Brussels. He said the most important thing is transparency. He said more openness can make sure that societies have access to what happens to our collective resources. I'm Dan Novak.
Years after suspending her studies, Brianna Mathis, a 30-year-old mother of two children, is in her first year back at Wallace Community College. Support staff at the school in Dothan, Alabama, suggested she return to finish her studies. A school advisor checks regularly on her progress, and also has helped Mathis with a financial aid issue. I definitely needed the guidance, and I probably wouldn't have gotten this far without the guidance, Mathis said. Two-year community colleges have the lowest completion rates of any kind of university or college. They also serve many of the students who need the most support. Nationally, about 36% of community college students who began in 2018 graduated within 3 years. In Alabama, the rate is about 30%. Students say that having advisors who can help them is often the most important influence on those who succeed. In Alabama, several community colleges are trying new ways to help students through difficulties until they graduate. Chattahoochee Valley Community College in Phoenix City has started the Strategies to Enhance New Student Engagement program, or SENSE. Advisors contact students who are in remedial classes, in academic trouble, or in need of extra support for other reasons. The program is supported by a 5-year, $1.8 million federal grant. We lose a lot of students because they don't think they have solutions to their problems, SENSE Project Coordinator Alicia Miles said. Miles said the goal is for coaches to stay with students until they get a job or transfer successfully. They try to help students get past problems. Such problems can include lack of transportation, lack of money for books, or a lack of family support. We're trying to put ourselves in the middle of those obstacles so that we can see higher completion rates, she said. But it's still a difficult task because we're fighting against a lot of things. Not all community colleges offer so much support, said Linda Garcia of the Center for Community College Student Engagement. A 2022 CCCSE report found that nationally, 53% of students said an advisor helped them to set academic goals and create a plan for reaching those goals. Janelle Congress, a first-year student at Lawson State Community College, said she needed help deciding on a major. However, her school's advising program never answered her emails or requests. You need an advisor to help you figure out those things, and to not have that is kind of tough, she said. Daryl Hatch Tokaimasa, an associate professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, said funding is the biggest problem to quality community college advising. He added that it is difficult to find advisors who can work weekends and evenings. Those are the times many community college students attend classes. In her first year at Chattahoochee Valley, Orianan Lewis failed three classes as she struggled with a long-term illness. She nearly lost her financial aid and likely would have had to quit, she said, without help. The new team of success coaches made a plan to help her keep her grades up. These grades would permit her to keep her scholarship. She is now close to graduation. If I didn't go in there and get the information and the support that I had, I don't think I would be where I'm at now, she said. I most definitely don't think I would have been in school still. I'm Andrew Smith.
You just heard this week's Education Report, presented by Andrew Smith. Andrew joins me now to talk more about the story. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew, why do community college students say having an advisor is so important for their success?
To finish community college or transfer to a four-year school, the steps are not always clear to students. As the student Janelle Congress said, students need help to figure things out. Plus, students do face other problems, such as getting money for books and transportation. Advisors show students the steps they need to take, and they help them deal with those other problems.
But it seems that a lot of students are not getting that help.
That's correct. And that may be part of the reason so many students do not finish their studies. And the 2022 report from the Center for Community College Student Engagement found only 53% of students said an advisor helped them create academic goals, and a plan for reaching them. That probably means a lot of students are not getting some advice that could help them.
If advisors are so helpful, why aren't there more advising programs at community colleges?
Well, because it takes money. Advisors must take time to meet with students in person or online. Some schools need the advisors to work on weekends or evenings, so it takes money to keep advisors in their jobs.
It sounds like if a school has advisors, students should use their help.
Yes, that's true. And hopefully good advice for our listeners, too.
For sure. Thanks again, Andrew, for being on the show today.
Of course.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Bob Doty and I discuss American arts and popular culture during the 1930s. Hard economic times and social conflict have always offered a rich source of material for artists and writers. A painter's colors can show the drying of dreams or the flight of the human spirit. A musician can express the tensions and uncertainty of a people in struggle. The pressures of hard times can be the force to lift a writer's imagination to new heights. So it was during the 1930s in the United States. The severe economic crisis, the Great Depression, created an atmosphere for artistic imagination and creative expression. The common feeling of struggle also led millions of Americans to look to films, radio, and other new art forms for relief from their day-to-day cares.
The most popular sound of the 1930s was a new kind of music, swing music. And the king of swing was a clarinet player named Benny Goodman. Benny Goodman and other musicians made swing music extremely popular during the 1930s. Swing music was a new form of jazz. Many of its first players were black musicians in small, unknown groups. It was only when more well-known white musicians started playing swing music in the middle 1930s that the new music became wildly popular.
One reason for the popularity of swing music was the growing power of radio during the 1930s. Radio had already proven in earlier years that it could be an important force in both politics and popular culture. Millions of Americans bought radios during the 1920s. But radio grew up in the 1930s. Producers became more skillful in creating programs. And actors and actresses began to understand the special needs and power of this new electronic art form. Swing music was not the only kind of music that radio helped make popular. The 1930s also saw increasing popularity for traditional classical music by Beethoven, Bach, and other great musicians. In 1930, the Columbia Broadcasting System began a series of concerts by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra on Sunday afternoons. The next year, the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, began weekly opera concerts.
In 1937, NBC asked Arturo Toscanini of Italy to lead an orchestra on American radio. Toscanini was the greatest orchestra leader of his day. Millions of Americans listened at Christmas time as Toscanini and the NBC Orchestra began playing the first of 10 special radio concerts. It was a great moment for both music and radio. For the first time, millions of average Americans were able to hear classical music by great musicians as it was being played.
Music was an important reason why millions of Americans gathered to listen to the radio during the 1930s. But even more popular were a series of weekly programs with exciting or funny new actors. Families would come home from school or work and laugh at the foolish experiences of such actors as Jack Benny, Fred Allen, George Burns, Edgar Bergen, and W.C. Fields. Radio helped people forget the hard conditions of the Great Depression, and it helped to bring Americans together and share experiences.
Swing music, classical music, great comedy programs. The 1930s truly were a golden period for radio and mass communications. But it was also during this period that Hollywood and the American film industry became much more skilled and influential. In previous years, films were silent, but the talkies arrived in the 1930s.
Directors could produce films in which actors could talk. Americans reacted by attending film theaters by the millions. It was a great time for Hollywood. The films had exciting new actors. Spencer Tracy, Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn, the young Shirley Temple. The most famous film of the period was Gone with the Wind, with Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh in the starring roles of Rhett Butler and Scarlett O'Hara.
No, I don't think I will kiss you. Although you need kissing badly. That's what's wrong with you. You should be kissed and often, and by someone who knows how.
Oh, and I suppose you think you're the proper person.
I might be, if the right moment ever came.
Directors in the 1930s also produced such great films as It Happened One Night, Mutiny on the Bounty, and The Life of Emile Zola.
The success of radio and films, as well as the Depression itself, caused problems for many American newspapers during the 1930s. The trouble was not so much that readers stopped buying newspapers. It was that companies talked about their products through advertisements on radio, instead of buying advertising space in newspapers. Nearly half of the nation's independently published newspapers either stopped publishing or joined larger companies during the 1930s. By World War II, only 120 cities had competing newspapers.
Weekly and monthly publications faced the same problem as daily newspapers. increased competition from radio and films. Many magazines failed. The two big successes of the period were Life magazine and the Reader's Digest. Life magazine had stories for everyone about film actors, news events, or just daily life in the home or on the farm. Its photographs were the greatest anywhere. Reader's Digest published shorter forms of stories from other magazines and sources.
Most popular books of the period were like the films coming from Hollywood. Writers cared more about helping people forget their troubles than about facing serious social issues. They made more money that way, too. But a number of writers in the 1930s did produce books that were both profitable and of high quality. One was Sinclair Lewis. His book, It Can't Happen Here, warned of the coming dangers of fascism. John Steinbeck's great book, The Grapes of Wrath, helped millions understand and feel in their hearts the troubles faced by poor farmers. Erskine Caldwell wrote about the cruelty of life among poor people in the southeastern United States, and James T. Farrell about life in Chicago.
The same social concern and desire to present life as it really existed also were clear in the work of many American artists during the 1930s. Thomas Benton painted workers and others with strong, tough bodies. Edward Hopper showed the sad streets of American cities. Reginald Marsh painted picture after picture of poor parts of New York City. The federal government created a program that gave jobs to artists. They painted their pictures on the walls of airports, post offices, and schools. The program brought their ideas and creativity to millions of people. At the same time, photography became more important as cameras improved in quality and became more movable. Some photographers, like Margaret Burke White and Walker Evans, used their cameras to report the hard conditions of the Depression.
All this activity in the arts and popular culture played an important part in the lives of Americans during the 1930s. It not only provided relief from their troubles, but expanded their minds and pushed their imaginations. The tensions and troubles of the Great Depression provided a rich atmosphere for artists and others to produce works that were serious, foolish, or just plain fun. And those works, in turn, helped make life a little better as Americans waited, worked, and hoped for times to improve.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.